Well, Kelly, Jay Richardson, I'm so happy that you're able to join us again to talk more at length about your wonderful first feature, Without a Net. Just really, really wonderful film about, you know, children and other folks in Brazil, and how, you know, using this art form, they're able to literally transform their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me, Wanda. What a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, and so tell us, tell our audience about how you came to go to Brazil in the first place and connect with this organization that is using circus arts as a tool for social change in the communities, one of the poorer communities in Rio.
Absolutely. The film is called Without a Net, and it's shot in the region of the northern part of Rio, which is called Praça 11, Plaza 11. And the area is known as a drug hotspot in the city. It's an area with a lot of crime and a lot of challenges for the youth growing up in that area. And there aren't a lot of opportunities for them. So the film follows four young people living in the area who have begun practicing with a circus program as an alternative to what is usually available in the area, which is, you know, playing in the streets and usually getting involved in the drug trade. So the film follows these four main characters, Platini, Hayana, Barbara, and Lee Jefferson, for 1 year as they audition for the end-of-year show, and then they rehearse and practice and get to their opening night. And then there's a coda ending 1 year later for where they are a year after opening night. And how I found the program, how I got involved in this project is that I am myself also, I have a history with circus performance. And when I graduated from college, I moved to Brazil, and I began practicing with a circus. And the circus that I joined had a social project as well as other programs going on. So I was able to practice in the circus and perform and get to know the people in the social project as fellow performers. And I think when you practice in a circus together and do your push-ups side by side and you know, share the experience of being in the same space practicing a thing that you love together, you share stories and you get to know each other pretty well. So I got to know the people in that circus, which was in Bahia in 2006, and I heard their stories of what it's like to grow up in that situation, running from the police and dodging bullets and struggling to find enough food to eat and a safe enough place to live and make it to the next day. But the excitement and the thrill of that, as well as the danger of that, really interested me in the way that the stories were told, and then comparing that to the performances that the participants in this social project were putting on was, for me, the spark that made me want to make the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what was the name of the circus that you performed with in Bahia, and how did you get to Bahia? Did you have a Fulbright or something, or...?
The circus that I was with in Bahia is called Picolino, and I did not at that time have Fulbright. I went there, I had just graduated from college, I had been working hard academically for my whole life, elementary school, middle school, high school, college, and when I graduated, I had had some experience with performance art. I had been a gymnast my whole life, and I had danced in college and at the Ailey School in New York, and I had had some circus, a little taste of circus training before. Mm-hmm. So I went after college. I traveled, and I ended up in Brazil, and I'd heard about the circus there, and I had done a little research, and I thought it would be fun to join a circus, a foreign circus. Mm-hmm. And I found that fun, and it was a good fit, and it turned out that they were having auditions for their company, And I auditioned, and I joined, and I was the only non-Brazilian in the play, so it was really a wonderful experience for me.
Okay. And what did you do in the circus?
I was an aerialist, mostly. I did trapeze and tissue and rope, but I did a little acrobatics as well because of my background as a gymnast.
Hmm. So you mean like you were walking on the rope up the air?
I did a little bit of tightrope, but what I mean is there's a vertical rope, which is like there are a few aerial techniques in the circus. One is the aerial tissue, which is like the silk hanging from the top of the circus tent that the performer climbs up and wraps herself up in and drops down and does some things like that. And the rope is similar. It's a rope that has a little bit of give to it, so the performer climbs the rope, does some interesting positions and wraps herself up and drops down and stuff like that. And sometimes if some of the ropes have a hoop at the top where you can put a hand through or an ankle through, and then and somebody at the bottom will turn the rope from below and spin the performer up at the top. So those were some of my favorites.
Right. Oh, so you did that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, it looks sort of, it looks like, what do you call it? It almost looks like ballet, but you're in the air.
It's compared to aerial, it's called aerial dance a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's really pretty. So, was there a net below you?
Well, I thought about those kinds of, that was the first time that I started thinking about those kinds of things because I didn't have health insurance when I was there.
Oh.
And I was thinking to myself, you know, I really hope I don't fall because if I fall and I'm in this Brazilian circus and it's just going to be, I'm going to have some challenges figuring out, you know, if I get injured, I hope I don't go unconscious because then I'm not going to be able to communicate that I have, you know, the ability to pay for health care, you know, for health, whatever. So that was the first time that I it sort of struck me that that being in a circus with that without protection in a way is literally being with the net and also figuratively being without a net. In my own personal experience, I do have a net. I have, in a sense, I have college. I have a family to fall back on if things don't work out in the circus, as I was thinking at the time that I was a performer. And then I was talking to the people in the social program and hearing how they really don't have anything to fall back on if things don't work out in the circus. And so that was, I feel like I could understand where they were coming from in a sense because we had this shared love of circus and we could perform on the circus apparatuses together. But I also recognized huge differences in our lives, and that interested me enough to decide to want to make a film about it.
So when you think about your own challenges, not completely without a net, but literally without a net, when you're performing with the circus in Bahia, and then you think about the young people that you interview, and you think about the custodian who didn't have the opportunities that these youth have, and has spent a lot of his time in prison. And prison in Brazil, I've seen movies about it, and you were actually there. Did you get a chance to visit any of the prisons?
No, I didn't, but I heard a lot of stories about it from that custodian, Ziquinho.
Yeah, and there are a lot of homeless children, a lot of children that live in the streets in Rio because of the instability of some of the family structures, you know, that net thing we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you could talk about maybe start with Junior, who started the circus, but he, you know, wasn't a man that came from a lot of wealth. He just had a little more stability, right?
Junior started the circus in, he was able to get the location in 2004, and the story of the circus is pretty interesting in and of itself. He had a history of being a social change kind of guy. He was interested in community movements and uprisings, and he was involved in the youth communist program. And so in 2004 he decided he had dabbled with social projects for children and teenagers at risk for joining the drug trade, and he'd been interested in the concept of using circus as a tool for social change. And
what were some of his other projects before the circus idea?
He'd been involved in dance groups. I mean, he led dance groups and stuff like that. He's not a physical performer himself, so he'd become interested in the concept of using physical performance as a tool to learn skills that can be transferred to other parts of the participants' lives. Things like learning cooperation in a physical way that can then be used in cooperation, the ability to cooperate in other in family situations or in in situations outside of physical performance. And then the idea of setting goals and making progress towards those goals and then achieving them. These things interested him. And also I think he wanted to be in the spotlight himself. He wanted some attention for some good work that he's doing. He likes attention. And so he felt that starting a program like this would bring some attention both to him and to this community that needed support. So in 2004 he was able to get the resources to purchase a circus tent, and somebody in the movie talks about how he came to that guy Bracky, and he said, "Can you store these stakes for me?" And Bracky said, "Yes, he could." A neighbor, and then during Cover of Night, the Junior and his friends set up the circus in this abandoned parking lot that had been used for nothing good, for drug dealing and child prostitution and stuff, as he says. During one night, he was able to set up this tent, and in the morning, the police came and they said, "You have to shut this down. This is illegal. You can't set up," because they were squatting. They didn't have the space. So the police tried to shut them down, but they were already children running around excited about the idea of a circus in their neighborhood, and there was just, the police realized that this could be very beneficial for the area, and they decided to let it stay.
Yeah, I just found it really interesting, that, how do you pronounce Junior's last name?
Petting.
Yeah, he grew up on the periphery, you're right, of Rio de Janeiro, and his first job was slaughtering chickens at the local butcher, where he was struck by the social and economic inequalities he saw all around him. And then that's when he became involved in community action campaigns, and this interest in social change evolved into the concept of founding a social circus, where disadvantaged kids and teenagers could learn circus skills for free. And then I was just sort of thinking about Paulo Freire, if that's how you pronounce his last name, who's known for the pedagogy of the oppressed, and he's Portuguese, and then from his work comes the theater of the oppressed, and as well as a social movement that's looking at sort of, the disadvantaged grassroots, and how they are, they are the seed for change in societies like you know, society in Brazil, particularly in the poorer neighborhoods or favelas or slums. And I didn't realize that Paulo Freire had been influenced by Frantz Fanon and Karl Marx.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, you know, with Junior that he was he had some roots in communism.
Mm-hmm.
And all that is sort of making sure that, you know, everyone shares in the economic viability of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And all workers are appreciated and all work is valued. So I just thought that was kind of interesting, you know, sort of like the underlying philosophical stuff. And I don't know if anybody was thinking about all this, but I'm sure you were because, you know, you got a degree from UC Berkeley.
Yes, and he was too. I mean, he reads all those guys.
Okay,
he was
cool.
A huge fan of Che Guevara. And, he likes... Junior is very interested in social change, and he's interested in being in the forefront of social change. So, that combination of things—the desire to be in the spotlight and the interest in creating social change—created a good combination for him to start this program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he stands on the shoulders of some really, you know, phenomenal, thinkers and work and philosophers and educators, because
mm-hmm.
I didn't even know that in South Africa, the South African anti-apartheid struggle, that they distributed ad hoc copies of Pedagogy of the Oppressed underground as a part of the ideological weaponry, and as well as in the Black Consciousness Movement. So it's like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and then in the 1970s and 80s, the book was banned. Well, you know, good old America. yeah. So tell us about these young people whom you profile and the custodian who, you know, he's sort of like, he's like almost like a foil, like, okay, these children, you know, because they have this opportunity, they aren't necessarily going to have the experience, you know, what, how do you pronounce his name?
Zequinho.
How do you say it again?
Ziquinho.
Ziquinho.
The Inho is a diminutive for little.
Oh.
So it's like when instead of Charles it'd be Charlie or Scotty or something like that. And so his name is, the English translation would be Zeke.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like little Zeke.
Okay. Nice.
So his story is really interesting. He grew up in a situation not unlike the main characters in Without a Net, where he had very few opportunities, and he didn't see a future through education, and he didn't see much potential for his life. So I think that adolescents get to a stage where they are wanting to have a place for themselves. They're wanting to be respected and treated as adults, or at least not ignored by society, and they don't want to feel invisible. And I think that when people come of age and they find themselves in a situation where they don't feel that they're being treated the way they want to, and they don't see an alternative for them to get to a place where they want to be, the drug trade provides them a situation where they get some of their needs met. Once they join the drug trade, they become respected. They become they command attention. They get status items like motorcycle, watch, girlfriend, something like that. It's very alluring to join the drug trade, if they don't see any other options for themselves. And so that happened to Ziquinho. He got to be about 12. He didn't see any options for his life, and the drug trade became very appealing, and he joined. And like with most people, you start low as an informant, letting the people high up on the totem pole know that who's coming into the area, and alerting people of potentially dangerous situations, and, you know, informant. And then you kind of rise, going up the ladder as you get older and improve yourself, until you're in a situation where there's no way out and you're carrying your gun and killing people, and it's there's no way out, and that's what happened to him. I mean, there are two ways out. There's death and there's jail, and that's what happened to him, and he was picked up by the police and taken to jail, and he lived in jail for 12 years.
Hmm.
And so he missed out on his whole youth because it was spent in jail.
Mm-hmm.
First it was spent as a drug dealer, and then it was spent in jail. And when he came out of jail as an ex-felon, he didn't have the education to make him an appealing job candidate, and also he had this history of felony charges and being in the drug trade, and he had tattoos that he couldn't deny his involvement, and so it was very hard for him to find a job, and so that's a huge problem, the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
of coming out of jail, finding no job, wanting to feed your children and survive, and having no alternative but to go back into the drug trade. So Zequinho had the opportunity, he was offered the opportunity to come work at the circus, which was a huge blessing for him, and an incredible opportunity, because he was able to work there and work with children and youth who he really felt close with. He wanted to serve as an example of what they should not do.
Mm-hmm.
They should not follow his path. So he's the poster child of reform. He really has become a very upstanding, honest man, and he's a great influence on the children and teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
At the circus.
Yeah, his compassion really comes through your lens.
Yeah, he watches them. He supports them. He's very compassionate. He's a very interesting guy.
Mm-hmm.
And his stories about being in prison and his real life experience of what it's like to grow up in those situations is it's really striking.
Yeah, you have a lot of sort of almost like symbols and within the piece around rehabilitation and change and compassion. And just think about the scene where one of your characters finds the little bird,
mm-hmm.
and they nurse it back to health, and then they put it in the tree. Which one of the children does that? I don't remember.
I love that scene. Yeah, it's one of the children. The child who finds the bird is named Igor, and he's not a main character in the film.
Uh-huh.
But that kind of thing happened. There were birds that fell in the circus, and I was really struck by when the first time that a bird fell in the circus, and I heard everybody yelling, "Oh, there's a bird, get the bird!" I was so nervous because I didn't know what they were going to do to the poor bird. But but it was the opposite of what I expected. You know, it was so caring what they did with this bird. It was really striking to me. They live in this concrete jungle. They've got huge challenges in every part of their lives, but they find these birds that need their help and need their compassion, and they provide it. They pick up the bird. They try to care for the bird. It's an injured little bird, and
mm-hmm.
they bring the bird to Zequinho, and Zequinho carefully takes care of the bird and tries to provide what the bird needs. But Zequinho, because he spent his whole life, so much of his life in jail without the education of, you know, growing up out in the free world, he doesn't know what a bird eats. So he tries to feed the bird what seems like the right thing, which is what he decides. Spaghetti. So he offers the bird some spaghetti, but he knows that the bird will do better in a tree in the sunlight. So he carries the bird out to the tree and places the bird in the tree, and that was really touching to me.
Mm-hmm.
The people, the children, and Zequinho are so caring of the birds. And I think also they watch the birds, and the birds land on the wires of the tent, and they look at the birds, and they think of what it's like to be those birds.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the themes that, that made it into the film, this idea of escape and flight and freedom of flying above, rising above the situation. And so there are many times when the characters are grasping for these fleeting moments of weightlessness that are represented in various things they do in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So let's talk about your other characters, DeJefferson, Barbara, Rihanna. Oh, no, that's not how you say her name. How do you say her name?
It's pronounced Hayana in Rio. The R is like an H.
Hayana, right. Mm-hmm. And Platini, is that how you say it?
Yeah, Platini.
Yeah, yeah, he's real sweet.
I agree.
And then you've got Alan.
Mm-hmm. Coach Alan.
Uh-huh. Coach Allen, yeah, he's. I just like the way he's with Platini. He's just so patient
mm-hmm.
and so encouraging.
Yes, Platini lost a brother to the drug trade who was the same age as Coach Allen.
Okay.
And so Platini, that brother, was unfortunately a big deal. A notorious drug dealer,
mm-hmm.
and he was killed by a rival gang 2 years earlier, before the film was shot. And after Pachini had just started practicing circus at that time, and then when his brother was killed, he became very involved. He really bonded with Coach Allen, who was the same age and a good role model for him, a very very much like a surrogate older brother
mm-hmm.
for him. And so that he loved circus, and he loved practicing with Coach Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hayana, let's start with her. She is an incredibly talented contortionist. She has always been very, very flexible, and she's really a great performer. And she used to, when she was younger, she was in rhythmic gymnastics, but her mother was paying for those classes, and then her mother lost the job and wasn't able to continue paying for the classes. So Hayana got involved in the circus program where she didn't have to pay. It's a social project,
mm-hmm.
and so she's incredibly talented and really fun to watch. I mean, top. Contortionist skill. Mm-hmm. And Barbara.
Let's go back to Hayana for a minute.
Sure.
I just thought it was really interesting. You say her mother, you know, she lost her job, and then she could no longer afford lessons. So within the circus community, there are varying economics and education. You know, some people have more education than others. Like Barbara, she drops out of school because it's just not happening for her where the circus is. And there are Hayana, she has medical insurance.
Yes, they do. They range in where they are on the economic totem pole, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
DeJefferson is probably in the worst situation. He mm-hmm. has 30 siblings, or he did have 30 siblings, but a number of them have been killed because of their involvement in the drug trade.
Right.
Or by accident, if mm-hmm. they're just, you know, the victim of a stray bullet.
Yeah. But one thing about DeJefferson, which I really like, he chooses not to be involved in the drug trade. He sells candy.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. He refuses to be involved. And, he's an incredible guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk a little more about him later. But to go back to Hayana, she is... of the main characters, she has the best economic situation. She's very close with her mother, and her mother cleans houses and babysits and things like that. So there's a little bit of income, and she has some relatives that have a little bit of more money. So she's in a better economic situation than the other three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what's really nice about the circus and the community that Junior has established is that it doesn't matter. Everyone is equal. Everyone gets along. I mean, even when Barbara is displaced by Hayana, because Barbara is the contortionist and she does everything, and then Hayana comes along, it's like, ooh, you know. So they displace her from her, you know, her throne. But she's got such a great sense of humor that, you know, she quickly embraces Hayana, because it's all about the whole community. It's all about the performance. It's all about all of them looking good together. And if Hayana has, you know, more sophisticated skills and better skills in a particular area, then, you know, she gets it. But yeah, Barbara, you know, we talked before. I just love her attitude.
So do I. She's so funny. She's so tough, and she's so mean. You know, when you first get to know her, she's just got this very hard exterior. She's a tomboy. She doesn't like anybody at the beginning. She fights. She's tough. When Hayana first came, she was so jealous of her because she took her place, you know? Barbara is flexible, but she's not out of the norm in flexibility. She's a very good acrobat. But Hayana came in, and she was, as Barbara says, mega flexible, and took her place. And so yeah, Barbara was really... really funny, really tough with Hayana at the beginning, but then they became good friends, I was going to tell you one thing, but if your audience hasn't seen the film,
oh, no, they've got to, they definitely got to see the film. Yeah. And your first screening is when is your first screening? Is it Saturday?
It is. Yeah, Saturday the 10th at 5 o'clock at the Roxy.
Right, yeah. And then you come over to the East Bay, I believe, on, is that the 12th?
That is, Monday the 12th at 9:30 at the Shattuck Cinemas.
And then when's your third screening?
Then we have the last one on November 14th, that's a Wednesday, at 7:15 again at the Roxy in San Francisco.
Yeah, so there are a lot of opportunities. So did you fly folks in from Rio?
Unfortunately, no, I wasn't able to. I had thought about that. I really wanted to, but the Jefferson, well, and Barbara, I had thought about bringing those too, especially.
Yeah.
It's really hard to make that happen. You know, to get a
visas and all that. Yeah.
So it just didn't. It wasn't possible, but hopefully we're going to have a screening in Rio.
Oh, when are you going to do that?
Hopefully we're going to have one early next year. And
Like January?
More like March or April.
Oh, okay, and, let me know. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I really want them to see it in the theaters. They've seen it in various stages and very close to its final, but only just on the iPod and on the DVD, and I really want them to see it in the theater.
Oh, yeah, certainly, because they are superstars.
Mm-hmm.
It's like such a great, great film. And then back to Barbara, she is, I don't know, Without a Net has a lot of different connotations. You know, we're talking about, you know, your work, aerial work, Without a Net, literal net, and then we talk about Barbara in some of the circus exercises. They actually throw people up, and they're supposed to catch them, and they threw her up, and they missed.
Yes.
And that poor young woman, oh my God, she was just talking about her injuries, you know, with a smile on her face.
Yeah.
Because she's a lot better now, but oh my God, I mean, she hit the concrete.
Yeah, they put everything into their practice and their performance. They love it, but they don't hold anything back. So yes, that's something that's so wonderful about them, and also so hazardous, because their passion, it overflows. I mean, they're so involved in their performance. They love it. They love to be applauded. They love to be on stage. They love to do more than they did yesterday. And that's great. That's all really good. But it's also, it puts them in a situation where there's potentially dangerous results. I mean, Hayana has had a number of injuries, and so has Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara, yeah, that line she has, she says, one time they threw me up. One time Jefferson threw me, and he forgot to catch me.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she says it is so comical. Oh, he just forgot. But yeah, I mean, then she landed on the floor, and
mm-hmm.
and so there are real risks to circus performance, and especially in a situation where the equipment isn't the best equipment, because it's a social project, so they get the equipment secondhand, or they get it from there is a professional school in Rio, but they get like the hand-me-downs, or
mm-hmm.
Or they just work with what they have, and they don't always have the training that they don't have the coaches that are able to train the performers in the best way. So Hayana, the contortionist, is mostly self-taught. She watches YouTube videos, she watches other contortionists, and she figures out how to do what they do. But she doesn't have the training that's really important to be a healthy contortionist.
Mhm. Right, yeah, it's really, you know, it's wonderful, but then it's scary.
Mhm. Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the Jefferson, because you know, he's a big guy.
Yes. He is. He is incredible. The Jefferson's childhood was spent washing cars and selling candy in the streets of Rio, and struggling to survive each day. He had, like I mentioned, a lot of siblings, and he had big struggles, and he wasn't able to go to school because he was always meeting the needs of the day, and he didn't... It's not that he didn't want to go to school. It's just that he had needs that he had to fulfill today, you know. And so, so he never went to school, and so he's illiterate, which isn't very common in Brazil. But it happens, as you can see, with him. And so he's completely illiterate. He can't identify his own name. He can't read street signs. He doesn't have a backup plan that he could be a delivery boy or something if circus didn't work out, because he can't negotiate the city by street signs. So one day he used to wash cars in that parking lot where the circus tent appeared, and the day that it appeared, he came there ready to wash cars, and there was a huge blue tent in his place of work.
Mm-hmm.
And curious, he walked over and asked about it, and they welcomed him. They said, "Oh, you're very welcome here. You're just the type of guy for this place. Have you ever done circus? What do you want to do?" And he looked around and he decided that he wanted to be a trapeze artist.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't seen him, you may think, "Oh, that's interesting." But De Jefferson is 300 pounds. So to be a trapeze artist at 300 pounds is quite remarkable, and for the audience, for somebody for watching him on the trapeze, is incredible. I mean, it's to see a body like that on such a delicate apparatus is very unusual. You never see a body like that, and it's wonderful to watch. It's really exciting. He's got great stage presence, and anyway, it's delightful to watch him on the trapeze.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good at it.
Right. Yeah. And there's just so much going on with the Jefferson. You know, because he, you know, really loves his mother and his siblings, and you know, he's trying to support them. And
mm-hmm.
at one point, you know, there are certain guidelines and certain rules as being a part of the circus, and he doesn't follow through on some of his responsibilities and gets suspended.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole idea of responsibility and trust, because you know, he had a specific role in the circus, and what happens if he doesn't show up? Mm-hmm. You know, what happens if he misses rehearsals? Then they don't know if he's going to show up because, you know, things are like that. And then the communication between the Jefferson and Junior, and neither one was hearing the other one.
Right.
You really captured that well in the film.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's one of the things that the circus tries to teach them, that they have to be responsible, they have to do what they say they're going to do, they mm-hmm. have to appear when they say they're going to, and they do, they learn that, and they have that naturally because I think that they unlike their siblings, they have this fire burning, they want to be somebody, they want to succeed in something, and one of the coaches describes that very well as well. And so they want to do the right thing. They want to be a part of the show and mm-hmm. do everything right. But they've got huge challenges that come up in their day-to-day lives. And what happens with the Jefferson, your audience will learn when they come to see the film. But he's unable to come to the rehearsals for personal reasons,
mm-hmm.
and then there's this, this conflict, because part of what the circus tries to teach the performers is that they are valuable, their opinions matter, they're important, they're crucial to the group, to the community, and everything, and so they're not replaceable,
mm-hmm.
And yet it becomes challenging when they get in a situation where their day-to-day lives come in conflict with being able to do what they said they were going to do. So yes, there's I'm kind of skirting around the details of this, so I don't want to give it away for your audience that mm-hmm. haven't seen it yet. But it's a coming head to head with these two situations.
Yeah, and I was just thinking as you were speaking about how when these young people, when these children show up, when people show up just in our lives in general, like, you know, we have our colleagues at work, and we have our coworkers, and we have our students if we're a teacher. And a lot of times it takes a whole lot for people to be able to show up and be present.
Mm-hmm.
And to Jefferson, I think there's a certain integrity because he's not going to show up in body if he's not showing up in spirit, and he just can't show up
mm-hmm.
because of what's happening. So I think it's better for him to not show up until he's ready to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And then his mother tells him, you know, that he needs to do this because he will regret it if he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he listens to his mother, which is nice.
Yeah. There's a story that I love that Jefferson tells that he didn't make the film. It just didn't make the cut, but it really shows something about his personality, which I'll tell you now.
Mm-hmm.
The name, in Brazil, there are a lot of names that people name their children off of, a lot of names from English or from the United States or whatever. Mm-hmm. So many people, the name Jefferson is not uncommon in Brazil, but with the pronunciation of Portuguese, if Brazilian Portuguese, if it's spelled the way that we spell Jefferson, starting with the J,
mm-hmm.
it's a soft J, and so it's Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
So some people put in a D before the J to make a strong J, Jefferson.
Right.
But our D. Jefferson was illiterate, so he didn't know that his name started with a D until somebody told him at about age 10.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to know what the D sounds like, and somebody said, duh. And he says, where's the duh in my name?
Mm-hmm.
And the friend said, well, you're the first letter of your name is silent. And he was offended. He said, I don't want the first letter of my name to be silent. So he renamed himself D. Jefferson. Which is probably the only D. Jefferson in the Brazil, or I don't know, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so fitting for him. He doesn't want the first letter of his name to be silent.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks volumes about his personality, I think.
Wow, that is so awesome. I have a couple of more questions. I wanted Coach Allen, he he practiced capoeira, the Brazilian African, Afro-Brazilian art form,
mm-hmm.
and in the streets and plazas of Rio de Janeiro. And I just wanted to sort of want you to talk about the capoeira, because a lot of people know about that art form, which is also it's also a way of self-defense,
mm-hmm.
and it's also connected to a spiritual tradition. And I wonder if you could sort of maybe tie that into sort of the personalities of the cast, and sort of this attitude that you find, particularly since you were in Bahia, in Salvador, so you really know about, you know, the African spirituality and culture that Brazil is really known for, because Brazil, outside of Africa, has the most, you know, has the largest population of people of African descent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like going to Africa when you go to Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there are these social and economic inequities,
mm-hmm.
you know, despite that. And it's, you know, it's also, you know, a former colony, mm-hmm. as well. So you have, you know, the Portuguese, you know, culture there and the language. And so I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that a little bit. And the last thing I want you to talk about is your dream team, your dream team crew.
Sure.
I mean, it's like serious dream team. It's like, oh my God.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, capoeira is it's the newest martial art form. It's very recent compared to most martial arts. It was started in Africa and then in these slave colonies when people were brought over from Angola, and it was a way to communicate and to practice fight. It's a martial art, so it's like a fight and a dance and a it's sort of like a chess game. They're all these moves that the two people are in a circle together, and they I suppose your audience is familiar with capoeira. It's beautiful to watch, especially when the people are very talented, like Coach Allen. I myself have not very much experience with capoeira. I've practiced a little bit, but
mm-hmm.
but I really appreciate it and enjoy watching it, and I have a little bit of experience, but. But yeah, Alan and some of the other people in the circus were extremely talented at capoeira and came to the circus through their involvement with capoeira.
Mm.
And yeah, capoeira is seen all over Brazil. I think in the areas that I'm familiar with, Bahia, it's in plazas, on streets, everywhere,
mm-hmm.
And out in the open air, and in Rio as well. And it's very popular, and it's and there are a couple of different kinds. There's
mm-hmm.
there's capoeira Angola, which is a slower version, and there's capoeira regional, which is a faster, more jumpier version, and Coach Allen is really interested in that kind, so he was really interested in all the flips and everything, and
mm-hmm.
because he is so, his body is so elegant, and he's so strong, he's so long, he's very tall,
mm-hmm.
he's really delightful to watch practicing capoeira. As far as the...
And I was wondering, did you get a chance to go to any of the quilombos, which are the independent settlements that former enslaved Africans set up, and they still exist now in Brazil?
Yes, I did. I visited a little bit. And I was also, I went to some of the capoeira rodas in Bahia that had a long history. One of them was held at an old hospital that had been a hospital for... a mental hospital, and so it was fascinating to be in this place and see things written on the walls and, mm-hmm. and fingernail scratches on the walls and the excitement in the place and like the spiritual presence was so strong there. It was really remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me see. The African influence in Brazil is huge. It's in the art. It's in the food. It's in the language. It's in the religion. Religion. Everybody follows. Many people follow Iemanjá, the goddess of the sea, who cares for the people working in the sea. And they give there's February 2nd is this day to appreciate Iemanjá and bring her flowers and bring donations to her to for another year of safety on the seas. And and their food is very influenced by African culture, and so yes, there's a huge African influence in both of those big cities, Bahia and Rio, and it's expressed in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now the last question you had about my dream team.
Yeah, your dream team, because I was just looking at, you know, starting at the last man on the list, Mark Berger, and I'm like, you know, Final Sound Mix, and I'm looking like, whoa, he holds the record for the most lifetime Academy Award nominations that all resulted in wins, and so I'm looking at The Godfather Part Two. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that's 1974. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975. Apocalypse Now, 1979. And Amadeus, 1984. I'm like, what? Well, I know him. And I was like, wow. So, yeah.
Yeah. It was a huge pleasure to work with him. As a matter of fact, I have a history with Mark Berger. I went to elementary school with his son.
Oh.
So I've been.
What elementary school did you go to?
Prospect.
Okay. Oh, I know Prospect.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it was, so I've been to birthday parties at his house and stuff like that. And and then when I was working on the film, I got in touch with him, and he wanted to see a work in progress, and then he had some advice about the film, about the storyline, and then when it was ready for the final mix, I asked him if he would be interested in working on it, and he was, and so we mixed it at Skywalker, and it was really a great experience to work with him and to mix it at that place.
So he's still teaching. He's adjunct professor of film studies at UC Berkeley.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. He teaches a great sound in video class at UC Berkeley.
Wow, awesome.
I worked with Quincy Griffin, the composer, who is also a Berkeley. I had a big Berkeley cohort here.
Yeah,
he went to Berkeley High, as I did, and I was interested in working with him. It's interesting what you were mentioning about the African influence, and I wanted to work with musicians that were from Brazil or at least from the African diaspora, and so I worked with him, and he worked with all Brazilian musicians. So that was, I think they created a fantastic score for the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I know his film Dart from Da Nang.
Oh yes.
That was really wonderful.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, yeah, and so are you going to have a soundtrack eventually?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, we're gonna have a DVD with extras that'll have the soundtrack and interview with the director and deleted scenes and stuff like that.
Nice. So. I like the one you told us about the Jefferson.
Yes, that one.
Cool.
And other ones. It's so hard to cut scenes, you know, because you get so attached to them. But
yeah, how long is your film?
It's 1 hour.
Okay. Wow, that was really hard. 1 hour. I mean, just, you probably had to make some really tough choices around cutting.
Mhm.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got a co-editor. And I want to also mention that it's also a love story. Yeah, it's really, really cool the way you can, like, fit a love story into almost any situation, huh? I mean, you like, you know, where you least expect to have a love story. It's like, oh, it's about a circus. Oh, there's a love story. It's like, that's so nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've got your consulting producer, John Antonelli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a joy to work with him. I got to know John when I was first becoming a filmmaker, mm-hmm. when I was, after I had come back from Brazil and I was applying for, I had applied for the Fulbright, and I knew that I would be going back, but I wasn't a filmmaker yet, mm-hmm. and I needed to take classes and I needed to learn to become a filmmaker in order to make Without a Net. And I met John at a film festival, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said, oh, I'm a filmmaker. And he said, oh, no kidding. Oh, what's your film? And I said, oh, well, nothing yet, but it's going to be fantastic. Just you wait. Mm-hmm. And I told him about the film, and he liked it. He liked the idea. He thought it sounded promising, and he offered to lend me his camera to do some practice shooting, and he just became such an important mentor for me and advisor, and then he's consulting producer on the film.
Nice, nice. Oh, I wanted to mention with regards to Quincy that he won Sundance Film Festival for his My Flesh and Blood,
mm-hmm.
and he was placed in the Benjamin. You see, his music was recently placed in the Benjamin Bratt film La Mission,
mm-hmm.
which people have been, you know, sort of looking for, and the ESPN documentary, The Two Escobars. But then for John, he's like, whoa. In association with the Mill Valley Film Group, has been producing award-winning documentary films for 25 years, and he directed and produced Sam Cooke, Crossing Over for American Masters,
mm-hmm.
and produced the Emmy Award-winning six-part series Global Focus, The New Environmentalist, narrated by Robert Redford, which I watched, and that's really awesome. And then Jack Kerouac, King of the Beats, and that's being reformatted in HD and redistributed by Culture Films International. So I guess that means it's going to be available soon or something like that.
Yes, it will.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. And it premiered at Sundance 25 years ago. So you got like some serious history here, and we're not even finished yet. So let's talk about your co-editor, Quinn.
Quinn. I was introduced to Quinn through John. John's been working with Quinn for many years on the series that you just mentioned, The New Environmentalists, as well as Sam Cooke and the other films that the Mill Valley Film Group has produced.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started working with Quinn. I worked with him on some other short projects and practice projects before going to Brazil,
mm-hmm.
and we worked well together, and I liked his work, and so he came on board as co-editor for Without a Net.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a joy to work with him.
Yeah, Quinn Costello, and then we have you, and you've got a an organization called Live Wired Productions, based in San Francisco, and you're the founder and executive director of Live Wired Productions. Is that the production company that produced your film?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a new production company. It has one film so far, Without a Net.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be more films coming out of Live Wired Productions soon. We've got a lot of ideas. I'm not quite ready to announce the next project, but,
mm-hmm.
but one is coming soon, so stay tuned.
Right, yeah. And I mentioned to you off the air that there's a wonderful group in Oakland, West Oakland, called Prescott Clowns, and I see them all the time.
Yes.
They're just so wonderful. Most of city programs, they always have the Prescott Clowns there, and they've been around for quite a while, and you said you knew them, of course.
Yes, I do. I've been in touch with David Hunt, the director of the Prescott Theater, and I think it's Prescott Theater Clowns, right?
Okay.
And they have a similar mission. They work with at-risk youth and mostly younger children, and their mission is to empower and engage youth to develop confidence and teamwork and perseverance and artistic talent and dedication to working for success. And that, when I learned about them recently, I was really struck by the similarities between the goals of their program and the goals of...